Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Tonight we're going to have an interesting talk. I know I teased this yesterday. I was going to talk about it during our show on Parashare, and then I totally bailed out on you guys. But that's because I knew my guest was coming on tonight, and I really wanted to chat with him about my experiences and the visit that I did this weekend to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, to the Crescent Hotel. Joining me, Bud Steed, is an author, researcher, paranormal investigator, and explorer of strange and lost legends. He's written and published 5 books: Haunted Natchez Trace, Haunted Mississippi Gulf Coast, Haunted Baton Rouge, Ozarks Ghosts and Hauntings, and a book on treasure legends called Lost Treasures of the Ozarks. His books contain a lot of history, and it's his belief that each ghost story, legend, or strange occurrence has its roots buried somewhere in historical fact. One of his new books out, Haunted Northwest Arkansas, that's what we're going to start off with, because that covers Eureka Springs and the amazing hotel that I had a chance to stay at this past weekend, at the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And I had a chance to meet this gentleman and talk with him and hang out. Bud, it is a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you having me on.
I wish I'd been feeling better. I know I tried to quarantine myself from you and as many of the guests as I could so I wasn't spreading my man disease to all of you, my man flu. But it was a pleasure getting a chance to do a kind of a Q&A and just being around and hearing you and watching your passion for this field of the paranormal. Tonight we're going to talk about Southern scares and lost legends, and we're going to have some fun doing that. But, Bud, talk to us and give us some of the history, if you would, of the Crescent Hotel, and then we can talk a little bit about what happened this weekend. And I know you had some profound experiences the last 2 weekends, but what is the Crescent Hotel and why is it so important?
Well, the Crescent Hotel was built back in the late 1800s as a hotel, then it moved on into a conservatory and college for women. And after that, a gentleman by the name of Norman Baker, he was basically a quack, but he had a cure for cancer. And he basically bilked people, you know, people desperate for, you know, their last hope for life. And he bilked them out of millions of dollars. And the son of a gun only did 4 years in prison for all of it and then retired to Florida. But after that, it reverted back to a hotel. And, you know, there's been a lot of deaths and that kind of stuff associated with it. When the hotel was being built, actually, a stonemason fell to his death. And his spirit's been seen in room 218 and elsewhere on the second floor. So it's just got a really, really interesting history, how it's morphed from, you know, or not morphed, but reinvented itself, I guess you could say, over time. It's just a really, really interesting place.
The history, too, with this location and all of the death that surrounds it and accidents, and then you've got the weird quackery of this doc that's trying to claim to cure people. Now, you had many doctors that were in that area that were utilizing the mineral springs waters, right, to try to revitalize and save people's lives?
Oh, sure. Yeah, back in fact, that's how the springs were originally found, was I believe there was a boy, this doctor, I'm not sure if his name was Ellis. I'd have to go check my notes now. There's been so many doctors in the area that used them, but he was directed to the springs by Native Americans, and it cured his boy's eyesight and cured some ulcers on his legs. And he set up a hospital in a cave that was right up above basically Basin Spring, where Basin Park Spring sits at now. And he treated soldiers from the Civil War and everything else. And word spread, and basically this town just kind of sprang up overnight. I mean, once word got out, people just started coming by the droves. There was tents pitched up everywhere. And it was, well, I think it was like the 4th largest town in Arkansas at one time. So, I mean, it's a...
Well, can I ask you something regarding the history of that area then? With these miracle springs, these mineral springs that people would go to, if you're, you know, you've got some kind of crazy rashes growing on you, and I know one of the patients he was having issues and losing his eyesight and began bathing regularly with this, and within 2 weeks his eyesight was kind of returned, wasn't there concern and worry that so many people bathing in these fresh springs would taint them and fill them with disease and bacteria?
Well, you would think so. I mean, that would be a modern day concern, but back then I think everybody's main concern was getting better. They didn't stop to think about anybody contaminating the springs. It was just how they could use them to make themselves better. And there was like 60 something springs, you know, right there in that one little area. So there was no shortage of water for them to, you know, to treat their ailments with. But, yeah, I don't think that ever occurred to anybody really.
Wow. Isn't that strange? You would have thought that would have, especially with the way water, you know, we see through history and all these places, how water would just carry bacteria and disease and wipe out entire towns because of that. But in this case, it really was almost like a miracle cure for some people.
Yeah, it did. It worked for a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of documented cases where people came in with, you know, eye infections and, you know, like you said, skin rashes and, you know, ulcers on their legs and things like that. And by using the waters, bathing in the waters, it supposedly was a miraculous cure. Now, whether it was all just simply the water or whether it was the fact they were outside, there was the fresh air, there was the water, you know, but, you know, conglomerate of healthy living, I suppose you could say, because they weren't in the main towns, their homes, you know, bottled up. And whether it was a conglomerate of that or whether it was just the springs itself, it's hard to say. But a lot of people had satisfactory results back then.
That's pretty remarkable in itself, right? So they were there was something to this. Were people bottling the water like miracle water and drinking it and using it in different ways as well?
Well, I've heard that there are some people that were bottling it and selling it. I think even Baker used that at one time, touting the miracle waters of the spring, using the miracle waters as part of his bogus cancer cure. But you know, that's you would think that was something like that would be, you know, somebody's avenue to instant wealth, you know, selling, you know, bottled tonic water of, you know, that's going to cure everything that's wrong with you.
Right. That's crazy. Now, did he have any success or with his claims? I mean, you would think that there had to be something, some legs behind what he was making these claims of to get so many people interested and involved in spending money.
Well, as far as I know, there was nobody had ever got cured from any of his cancer cures. I mean, he would take and he would inject carbolic acid in people. And at one point, he cut open a guy's skull, a piece of the guy's skull, and actually packed in corn silk and crushed up watermelon seeds and things like that and told him, "You're cured."
What?
And, oh, yeah, dude, he was a piece of work, this guy was. He was a vaudeville entertainer in his early years, and he was just he knew how to sell it. You know, and that's what he was doing. He was selling this cure, and he was just completely, totally full of crap. But people were desperate. I mean, they were on their last legs, you know, and he played to that. And that's how he made his money. But I don't think there was ever a documented case of anybody ever being cured. In fact, where the new wing, you know, I don't know if you went over that way or not, but it'd be the south end of the hospital. There was a new wing that was added on when Baker had the place. And he had metal doors put up there, and that's where he put his terminal patients because he didn't want to hear any of the screams or the cries out in pain or anything like that. He shoved them all over there. But very, very – he was just a piece of work, that guy was.
Yeah, it seems like it. Now, I did get a chance. I think they said I was staying in the new wing. I was in room 409. Are you familiar with that side of the building?
Oh, yeah.
Right. So when you was at the new wing, I was standing – when you come in the front door, it's immediately to your right. It was above the conservatory and all that. Was that more of the new area that I was in?
No. It was on the other side of the building.
Oh, okay.
Actually, came in the front doors, if you made a left and went around like you're going towards the dining room, there's that little set of stairs that went up. And if you went up that all the way to the fourth floor and then hung a left, you kind of went down two you know, small little sets of stairs and you were in the new wing.
Now, the place was pretty interesting. First of all, I love the look of it. What a beautiful place. This it's made out of, is it limestone? Is that the basis for this building?
Yeah, it's all locally quarried limestone, and it's all dry fitted. There's no mortar or anything else like that in there. It's all just dry fitted together. And, yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful building. I mean, but all that limestone, you know, I mean, that's to me that I think that's why that place has so much activity in it. I think that limestone has something to do as a conductor, you know, for the paranormal, because, I mean, you know, they use the quartz and limestone and stuff like that when they're making capacitors for radios and electronics and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I don't know. I think there's something to that. But yeah, it's all just dry fitted, locally quarried limestone. I mean, it's very well put together. I mean, you got to consider back when that was done, you know, in the late 1800s. I mean, that was all done by hand. And I mean, that thing is just smooth. I mean, the fitting of the joints and everything on the stone is just perfect.
I wonder, and I'm going to try to look it up, but what was $285,000 worth today in what year was it made?
1886, I think.
Yes, that's right, because it's known as the 1886 Crescent Hotel. Right. I wonder if I could find some kind of deal. The inflation calculator, let's see what it says here. If I put in $285,000, which I believe is what they told me, it was, and I calculate that. Let me see where it comes in. That would be, in other words, $285,000, which is what they spent back in 1886 to build this building. And I think they said it just took 2 years to complete it, correct?
Yeah, it went up really quick, considering they were doing everything by hand, and they were using mules and
right.
pulleys and levers to get the rocks, the stones up into place. It was quite an endeavor.
Bud, check this out. $7,102,252.92 in current
Good
money.
Lord.
To
That's
build,
a chunk of change.
Yeah, that is a huge chunk of change. And it drew a lot of people to that area. You know what? I was surprised. I got to be honest with you. I heard Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and I thought, Jerkwater, USA, right? In the middle of nowhere. I've never even heard of Eureka Springs. I know it's not far. It's like, what, an hour, hour and a half from Branson, Missouri, right? It's a couple hours from Mountain Home, Arkansas. It's, you know, it's kind of centrally located. And then I heard how people from Branson, a lot of the entertainers like to come to Eureka Springs. And I will tell you, when Sean Paul from Intrigue Theater drove me around, that was such a beautiful place. You know, even Jumbo Jesus you guys have out there in Eureka Springs was pretty neat. But they've got this huge statue, much like the one in Brazil, of Jesus. And they do a passion play and everything with this kind of historic streets and everything. But it was beautiful. And what a neat, unique old town. I think Sean was telling me the signs all had to be hand-painted, right? They're not allowed any gaudy or kind of audacious-looking signs outside of the buildings. They're really trying to recapture that original feel from the 1800s.
Yeah, well, I think most of the town is actually on, or maybe the entire town is on the National Historic Register. I mean, they're trying to keep that historic look to the entire town, but you know, the entire town, if you noticed, it's made out of the same limestone that the Crescent Hotel is made out of. You know, the Basin Park is, the New Orleans Hotel, all the little shops downtown for the most part are of the old town part there on Spring Street, all made out of limestone. And it's just a unique place. And, of course, there's not a flat piece of ground in the entire town.
Right. I heard they couldn't, the high school can't have a football team because there's not a flat enough piece of ground for them to put a football field on.
No, I hadn't heard that, but yeah. I really doubt it. No, yeah. I mean, there's not a flat piece of ground anywhere right there.
I heard from many different people when I was in the town. But anyway, so they actually own, the owner of that owns the Basin Hotel and the Crescent. And you were talking a little bit about this, but let's go into some of the ghost stories. And while I was there, I met this really charming group of people, and the one daughter-in-law or I don't know, the son's girlfriend was not keen on the paranormal. And it was funny to me because she was the only one that had like a very profound experience. She was across the room, and I want to say, is it Michael, a little boy named Michael there?
Michael was the stonemason in room 218. There's a little boy who bounces a ball from time to time called
right.
Brickley.
Okay, yeah, he was the one that came across, and I thought she had said Michael, so maybe I'm mixing up my stories. But as she's standing there with her back against the wall, she could feel a hand kind of rub along her back as though it had had its arm around her and rubbed. And she was absolutely freaked out by that. And there were a lot of people having experiences. Somebody kept knocking on my bedroom door. And I could see the gap underneath the door. I could see the gap, and there was nobody standing there. And I knew the difference because Sean had come to my room a couple of times to get me to go to lunch. And when he'd knock, I could see the foot, you know, the shadow of the feet underneath the door. And I would hear these knockings the first night. It was at about 2:30 in the morning after I'd been in bed for an hour or so. And I got up and peeked out, and there's nothing there. And there's no creaking down the hall. And I go back to bed again. I hear knocking a couple hours later. I get up and check again. There's nothing there. The next morning, of course, when I come out and I'm talking to a few people, I'm right by that banister where I guess the one guy fell to his death, and the little girl is seen. Her spirit is seen around that area.
Right.
So, yeah, that's funny.
The little girl fell. Yeah, the little girl fell through the railing and fell all the way down, all the way to the basement, basically, and died. But, yeah, what you're talking about, the knocking, I was in room 425, and I'd come in after the ghost hunts when everybody started going to bed, and I could, you know, take a little time for myself. And I'd go in the room, and I'd get ready for bed, and I was in a very corner room, and there was no balcony out there, no nothing. There's no pipes that ran through the wall, no nothing. I'm laying in bed, and I hear this rapping on the outside wall, bam, 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 bam. I'm like, come on, guys, you know, I'm tired, you know. And then about 30 minutes later, it's bam, 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 like somebody trying to get my attention. I get up. I thought, well, maybe it's echoing off the wall, and it's somebody at the door. You know, I go look at the door, and nobody around, you know. And I'm like, this is getting old. Lay back down and just bam, 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 bam on the wall. And I said, Jesus Christ, I'm tired, but you guys knock it off. Never heard another thing the entire night. So.
Well, you and I had a couple of knockers that night that wouldn't leave us alone, yeah. It seems, huh? Banging on the on the doors and walls. That's cool. I was astounded as we were doing the ghost tour, and they were telling the story of this one woman that's often seen, and there was a photograph. And I've seen a lot of crap photographs, bud, in years that I've done what I do on this radio show. But that photograph of the guy at the bar, I think it is, with the woman standing outside the window. Do you know which picture I'm talking about?
Are you talking about the ones that's in the book downstairs on the coffee table?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
That was pretty amazing and astounding. And that place really has an energy to it. I loved visiting the Stanley Hotel. That became like a second home to me for many years. But I never kind of felt the kind of energy that I felt at the Crescent. I got to be honest with you. And I don't mean that as just a rub. The Stanley always felt pleasant and warm and inviting, but it never felt that active. And we would have weird things happen. There's no doubt about it. This place, you walked in and it was warm and loving and inviting, but you could tell this place had some definite energy. And whether it's... You and I kind of talked about it. If you don't mind me saying real quick, you and I had talked about it during our Q&A. You know, I don't know if I'm feeling or vibing on the fact that there's dead people walking around, or is this place just so rich in energy that we're just kind of walking through tepid pools of time. And in certain areas, you're just picking up on what's going on in their real time. And, you know, we may be the reflections, the ghosts, yeah. the weirdness that they're sensing back in the 1800s and early 1900s.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a viable possibility. You know, but I think the fact, you know, well, you know as well as I do that the theory has been around for forever that, you know, limestone and running water is a conductor for spiritual energy. Well, here you have a hotel that's built out of limestone rock sitting on top of a limestone mountain.
Right.
With a running stream underneath it in 62 or 63 springs, all within a mile of that area. So if any place is going to be a conductor for spiritual energy, it's going to be that place, you know? And I think that's what you pick up on when you walk in. I think when you walk in, all that energy is kind of amplified from the building. Now, whether it's a time slip and, you know, we're seeing something that's in actual real time, but in a different era, or whether it's actually ghosts we're seeing, I don't know. Personally, I think it's ghosts we're seeing because I've had too many weird interactive experiences.
All right. Well, don't leave us hanging. You say something like that. What are some of the weird interactive experiences that you've actually encountered?
Well, I had one. I've talked to a lot of different people about it, trying to get a handle on what actually happened. And I to this day, I still don't know. But you know how that long hallway from the spa going to the morgue area, I was sitting down there one night. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was sitting down that hallway by myself, and I had the lights that were on. The lights are all on one circuit. You can't turn off each individual light down that hallway. You flip a switch and boom, everything goes dark. I'm sitting about in the middle of the hallway, and all of a sudden the light on the far right just goes out. I'm like, okay, well, maybe the bulb burned out. Second light goes out. I think, well, that's a little bit odd. Right. You know, and then I look over at the door and I can see this shadow of somebody standing there. I'm like, okay, well, that's kind of creepy, but it could be just somebody from the staff came down to make sure I wasn't somewhere I wasn't supposed to be. About that time, all the lights went out. And you have to understand, I'm sitting on a carpeted floor leaning against a drywalled wall. When the lights come back on, I'm sitting on a concrete floor leaning against a rock wall. The lights are all gone, and it's got the institutional-style caged lights with the light bulbs in them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Here comes this nurse that was the shadow I'd seen. She comes walking down or pushing this gurney down the hallway, and there's a body on the gurney, and she locks eyes with me. And I'm just kind of like, what the hell is going on here? You know, I couldn't get my head wrapped around it for a minute. And then she walked past me, and then boom, lights went back out, lights come back on. I was right there where I had been, the drywalled walls and everything. And I got so sick all of a sudden. I thought I was just going to just heave my guts up. I had to just get up. I was all wobbly and weak and try to get out the door to get some fresh air. But to this day, I don't know exactly what happened right there. I don't know if it was a time slip like we talked about. Some people had said that they were projecting something into my head that they wanted me to see. I don't have any idea what the hell went on, but it really kind of creeped me out. That was one of the creepier experiences I had at the hotel interactive, where she, you know, she locked eyes with me. It wasn't just like a residual entity that was just going on about their business, oblivious to everything and everybody. She turned her head and she locked eyes with me as she walked past and kept turning her head with her eyes locked on me. Like she knew I was there. And I can't explain it. It's completely freaked me out. And then, you know, because there's the story of the nurse. There's that nurse that's seen up on the third floor. She's seen down in the basement. She's seen in the morgue area. I don't know. She was an attractive girl. She was probably in her late 20s or so. She's kind of cute for a dead person.
Or what.
Yeah, for a dead person, she was pretty hot. But,
yeah.
You know, I don't know what the hell that was, but that was one of the strangest experiences I've ever had.
Wow, that's pretty powerful. And you keep going back. Now, you also had an experience, didn't you say last week during the seance, and then some fascinating things that happened this week during the seance?
Yeah, on the first weekend, me and John Healy and his wife were given access to go to the Basin Park Hotel. And we were up in the Barefoot Ballroom. Well, one of the stories associated with the Barefoot Ballroom is that if you go in there late at night, and you sit down against a wall and you're really, really quiet and you don't move around and you just listen, pretty soon you'll start to see shadows move in front of the windows. And you got to remember, you're five stories up. There's nothing that's going to be walking around out there. And if you listen, you'll start to hear the faint murmur of conversation, music, like there's a party going on, that kind of stuff. And if you stand up or if you move, then everything goes dead silent. I kind of wrote that off. Is just an urban legend. But when I was researching the haunted Northwest Arkansas book, I actually went up there at 3 o'clock one morning and I sit down and I actually experienced all of it. I would stand up, the shadows would boom, they were gone. Music would stop, conversation, all that. Well, when we went up this last weekend, or the first weekend of the event, we were up there and we were doing an EVP session and I had my millimeter out and I was measuring temperature and fluctuations, EMF fluctuations, and all of a sudden, my throat started getting tight, and I couldn't breathe. It's like somebody was choking the living hell out of me. Just big, firm grip, just choking the air off. And finally, I managed to get up off the floor. I was sitting on the floor and made it out into the atrium where the elevators and everything are. And as soon as I walked through the door, it stopped. And I managed to get my breath back and kind of got myself settled down a little bit there. And I went back in, and my neck was burning. And I asked John, I said, would you look at my neck and see if there's anything on there? And I pulled my turtleneck down. There was a handprint on my neck. You could see the fingers and the white spot there where my throat was at, where the web between the thumb and the fingers were at. And you could clearly see something had choked me up there. But that was a first for me, too. I've had a lot of firsts at the Crescent and the Basin Park, actually.
Does that ever, when you have an experience like that, does that ever put you off? Do you ever have to take a respite from doing investigations and checking this out, or does that just spur you on?
Yeah, it's never made me take a break from anything. I mean, if anything, it just piques my curiosity more as to, why did that happen? You know, I can't imagine anybody wanting to choke me. I'm such a nice, charming guy. You know, I got such a great personality. I couldn't imagine anybody disliking me enough to choke me, you know. Being a little facetious there. But, you know, it doesn't put me off. I mean, it just, like I said, it makes me want to know why something like that happened. You know, can I replicate it? Not that I want to be choked again or anything. I'm not looking for that kind of action. But, you know, just can it be replicated? Is there a logical answer why that happened to me? You know, so, you know, it doesn't put me off.
All right. Talking with our guest, Bud Steed, and we've been discussing the haunted and very active hotels there in Eureka Springs. You've had great activity, a lot of things going on there. And I know there were people reporting back to me during the ghost hunts of being touched, of seeing shadows moving about, hearing things, voices, knockings, which we both experienced. And there's so much of this activity. And then I come to find out that Eureka Springs is really well known for being haunted all the way around. Bud, why do you think there's so much activity in this sleepy little village?
I think it boils down to, you know, like we talked about earlier, about the limestone and the water magnifying everything and the history associated with the place. I mean, you had the roaring 20s, the gangsters coming down, you know, and then the 40s, you had them coming down, and, you know, they had all the illegal gambling and prostitution and that kind of stuff. It was kind of like a wide open little place there for a long time, you know. I mean, it was out in the middle of nowhere. There was no easy way to get there. So, you know, the criminal element felt, you know, rather safe coming down there. So, you know, you had killings and stuff like that. There was a guy behind a basin park, had his throat cut, tried to run out on a gambling debt, and they cut his throat. He's seen from time to time around there. And, you know, there's just so much history, you know, so much death, you know, from the Civil War, from the accidents building the places. And I think that all builds up and contributes to the reason why the place is so, you know, so active.
I love the fact, too, that people are so warm and understanding about it in that town. Everybody just seems very accepting of the fact that this is a crazy little burg filled with ghosts, and that's pretty neat. Now, are there any hot spots that have just creepy stories, whether it's at the Basin or at the Crescent or any of the other locations in that area?
Yeah, I mean, the Basin Park has a lot of stuff associated with it. The you know, the guy who got his throat cut, he's seen from time to time. There was a lady that was on the tours, I guess a couple of years ago during the ESP event, that a thin red line appeared on her throat, and it was kind of burning, I guess, and it was kind of reminiscent of the, you know, the guy who had his throat cut. There's the prostitute that was allegedly killed at the Palace bathhouse and hotel now. She haunts the place. She has been seen by several people. One lady in particular actually interacted with her through a bottle of perfume, of all things. She noticed that the spirit, you know, had interest in this bottle of perfume, I guess, you know, from one lady to another, you know, a perfume kind of thing. But when she got ready to leave, she told the lady, you know, she told the spirit, you know, if you want the bottle of perfume, it's yours. Just take it. And they went out and loaded their car up. And when they came back, the bottle of perfume was gone. They looked all over and couldn't find it. But yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of strange stories around that place, I guess. You know, they've seen Civil War soldiers up around the cave, where the hospital was at, a little Brecky. You know, there at the Crescent Hotel, he died when he was just a really young boy, and you see him from time to time playing, you know, in the hallways. And then you got the little girl whose mom worked there, and she was on the fourth floor, and she was sticking her toy out over the stairwell, and her mom hollered at her, and she lost her balance and fell between the railings and fell all the way to her death. And it was really a horrible kind of a deal. But the morgue area, you know, I mean, when Norman Baker had this place, I mean, this just kind of shows you what this guy was like. He had this room called the parts room. And whenever somebody would die, and he did actually have real doctors who worked for him, and they would do autopsies on some of these patients, and they'd collect body parts. Well, Baker kept them in little jars and stuff in this room called the parts room, and he had them all lining the walls in there. And a lot of people have experienced things in there, being touched, pushed. The cooler where they stacked the bodies, Wyatt, one of the tour guides, was in there last weekend, and he was laying on the floor in the cooler with the door shut, and all of a sudden it's like a face popped right up in front of his and scared the living hell out of him. And but yeah, there's a lot of creepy stories around the place.
That's great. Now, what about talking, you know, about the spooky stuff? Are there elementals and other kind of demonic creatures that walk the grounds of Eureka Springs? Have there been many, kind of retellings of tales like that?
Yeah, there's been some demonic stories told. Not sure I place much faith in them, just because the vibe, you know, you've been in that town, the vibe of that town just doesn't seem to carry that menacing kind of feel to it. You know, like you would associate with a demonic type of entity. But there's been some elementals that seen, what I would consider elementals, you know, like little small woodland type entities, creatures. But then again, I think it goes back to that vibe. You've got that hippie kind of vibe thing going on there. That's all peace and love and all that kind of stuff. So those kind of sightings and stories are kind of few and far between. Most of the stuff that you find about Eureka Springs and the stories and everything are pretty positive for the most part, with, you know, with the exception of the guy at the Basin Park that likes to joke people. But, you know, for the most part, it's a pretty positive, haunting type of place.
All right. Now, you've had a chance to kind of explore all over. You know, and our listeners, they love the creepy tales and the weird stuff. So I do want to hear, you know, you've written how many books now? Five, six books?
Yeah, I've written six books. I'm under contract for three more.
Oh, well, congratulations. Well, let's hear some of the creepier tales when we return. And I also want to hear about some of these lost treasures and cursed places and things like that when we return with our guest. Bud Steed is here for us this evening as we talk about the spooky South and crazy lost treasures of the Ozarks and more when we return right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. And today we're talking with Bud Steed. I had a chance to meet with him this past weekend, and we had a great chance to talk with an amazing audience of people. And tonight we're talking Southern scares and lost legends. Bud Steed, my guest, he's written 900 books, I think, at this point. And we're talking about some of these. And I asked you to bring me some of the spookier tales, if you don't mind. And we could jump through your different books as you mention them. We do have a link up for listeners that are interested. Just go to darknessradio.com and click on our Killer Deals link. That's darknessradio.com. Click on Killer Deals. And there you're going to find a link to all of the books that you hear mentioned on the show. So we will have Haunted Northwest Arkansas, and we will also have The Lost Treasure of the Ozarks, Missouri and through Arkansas. You'll be able to find those books and more right on our site, so go check it out for yourself. Let's get into some of the creep factor of the hauntings. And have you ever been on an investigation or been at a place that left you really unnerved and frightened, aside from, you know, some of the stories you've already shared with us?
Oh, dude, please. There was a place in Montreal. In the Ozarks.
How did that go? Oh, dude, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little small, just Ozarks country town. And, I mean, it's out in the middle of, you know, BF nowhere. And we were called in to investigate this place by the owner. Now, this gentleman was an older man, lived by himself, and his son and his family lived in a house trailer next to the main house. And we started down this to get to this place, and it's, you know, down this real long dirt road, and the directions were at the red barn, turn left. When you see the cow in the field, turn right, that kind of thing. You know, you're so far back in the sticks. And we get to this house, and we go inside, and there's no pictures at all on the wall. There's no decorations. There's no pictures. There's no TV. There's a chair. There's a table. There's a couch. You know, just the basics. And this old man's living there by himself. Well, we're doing the pre, you know, investigation interview with the guy, and Dave Harkins, I don't know if you know him or not, but he was with us, and he started getting paranoid, and he started looking around at everybody, and pretty soon he gets up and he goes outside. And so I get up and go outside. Dude, you okay? And he's just all kind of wigged out. And he said, you know, he said, I was sitting in that house. He said, and I figured out how every one of you guys knew everybody else that you'd gotten me out there to kill me. And we're like, dude, please, you know, we've investigated for years together. You know, just relax, man. It's all good.
Right.
You know, so we go back in there and we're talking to this guy and we're only getting bits and pieces of the story. And come to find out there was three male members of his family that had killed themselves with the same gun in the same horse stall in the barn, all within the space of 2 years. And so something is getting in your head out there, right? So the son shows up and we ask him, he said, well, can we go in your trailer? He goes, I don't care what you do with that trailer. He goes, I'm not going back in there. So we ask him, you know, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, we were sitting there. He said, we've always had weird things happen. He said, me and my wife and my kids were sitting there at the table eating dinner, and all of a sudden all the cabinet doors just start opening and slamming, and the drawers are flying out. Pictures are falling off the wall. He said, we just left everything. We got up and left, and so we've been back in there since. And sure enough, when we went in there, there was the plates on the table, his wallet and change on the counter, and, you know, just everything right there. So we're doing our investigation, and there's this hammer laying by the fence where somebody had fixed the barbed wire fence, and they just laid the hammer down next to the post. We didn't hear anything when we were walking past there. We were just talking. When we got to reviewing the audio later, we can hear this voice, and it's a really deep, gravelly, kind of like an echoey kind of voice, and you can hear it clearly go, pick up the hammer, and do them good. You know, and we're just like, what the fuck? And,
wow. Holy cow.
So we're this one girl who's with us. She was always one of those kind of people who's got, you know, use my energy, come touch me. You know, we're all sitting there going, don't do that shit. You know, don't open yourself up like that. And she's just like, you know, use my energy. Well, something used her energy. All right. Because all of a sudden her eyes rolled back in her head and she just got this really strange expression on her face, and it's like 30 degrees out. She broke out in a sweat. It's just pouring out of her. And she's looking at everybody and she's going, you're all going to die. It's going to rain blood and all this kind of off the wall crap.
We're like, holy mackerel.
Are you kidding me? Yeah. So we got her in the car and she's still spouting all this crap off, you know? And by this time, everybody's kind of wigged out, you know, we're just like, this ain't cool. And it's like 2 miles down the road before she finally snapped out of it. When she come out of it, she was just like, what are we doing in the car? She goes, I was over by the fence earlier. You know, how did I get in the car? You know, she was completely out of it. And we went back to the guy and we started asking him more questions. And I'm what they call a grave dowser. I can use dowsing rods to locate graves. My grandfather taught me how to do it. And I can tell you where the head of the body is at, whether it's male or female, how deep they're buried, how wide the grave is, how long it is, that kind of thing. And so we were back there on the other side of the creek and found three graves. Well, the old man would not verify that the graves were back there. Every time we'd bring it up, he would just kind of change the subject, you know. So there was just something weird that was going on out there that was getting in your head. And I think that's what caused those three guys to kill themselves in that barn stall. And we asked him, he said, well, we want to come back out and we want to set up and do a good formal investigation. We want to do it in the house. We want to do it in the trailer. We want to do it in the barn. And then we'll do a roving investigation of the grounds, trying to get EVPs out there. Boom, he shut everything down. He said, absolutely not. He says, I want you guys to go and I want you all to go right now. So we don't know what was out there, but whatever it is was pretty damn mean. And that was one of the few times that I really wasn't disappointed that we couldn't go back. You know, I was kind of actually relieved that the old guy just told us just to leave. He didn't want us on the property anymore, even though he was the one who originally called us. And as far as I know to this day, nobody's ever been back out there to do anything with it. But it had long-term effects on our team, too. We had like 9 people at the time that was on our team, and it actually caused our team to splinter up, and people went their own ways. It actually broke up our team, that case did. So, but that was really a really weird case. I've never had something like that before where I was that unnerved, you know.
When you're gathering these stories as well, do people ever give you, like, what's one of the most terrifying tales they've given to you And then do you elect to go put yourself into that position to try to investigate when you hear something malevolent? Or do you just, you know, I'm just going to go by your story for this one.
Yeah. Well, I'll take a lot of people's stories on face value because there, a lot of times there's no way you can go to investigate the place that happened in, you know, on private property that they were living at that they no longer own or something like that. But when I was researching the book for the Haunted Mississippi Gulf Coast, I talked to this young lady who was a waitress, and at nighttime she would cut through the old Biloxi Cemetery to get back to her apartment. You know, this is right across the street from the beach, and it sits up on probably the highest piece of ground that's there, which isn't very high. And these are the old above-ground tombs like you see in New Orleans, you know. And these are from the early 1700s. And she got accosted by these two or three guys who had basically planned to rape her. They grabbed her and drug her behind one of the tombs. And she wasn't really quite clear what happened, but one of the guys was basically thrown off of her, and just a whole melee of things went on. One guy was, as she said, his shirt looked like somebody took claws on the front of his shirt. The guy that was holding her down and just opened up his shirt with, you know, like claw marks and just cut him all the way through his chest and his belly and everything. And I thought, well, that's kind of unusual for, you know, a cemetery like that. But, I mean, it's a pretty peaceful place, I thought. But I went, and she told me which tomb it was at, you know, which above-ground tomb. So I went, and I'm sitting there by the vault, and I'm doing an EVP session, and I'm getting these voices that are coming out of nowhere. I can hear them audibly. And it's like, get out, go away. I don't think much of it. You know, you hear that stuff all the time. And I started getting this burning feeling on my arm. And I looked down at my arm, and I've got these three big, long scratch marks that go down my arm. And I really didn't think much of that either, because that's happened before, too. But a storm was coming in, and you got this lightning flashing, and you got these big old oak trees with the moss hanging down them and everything. And the lightning would flash in the tomb right across from me. There's a guy standing there. Lightning would stop. He was gone. Lightning flashed again. He's there again, but he's 2 feet closer to me. You know, and I'm like, what the hell? Lightning would flash again. He's 2 feet closer to me. When the lightning had flashed again, I mean, this dude's right up there, right up in my face, just nose to almost to nose. And I went to push him back, and I pushed completely through him. You know, he wasn't there. He wasn't solid. And the lightning flashed again, and he was gone. And he had old fashioned clothes on. Almost looked like old farming kind of clothes, you know, like the old rustic type of clothing. But I mean, I went to push the guy back because I thought he was some kind of a derelict, you know, and I thought I was going to get into a fight or something there. And I went to push him back and just right through him. And that was one of the times when I went and investigated somebody's story that I actually had something kind of cool happen.
Yeah, gosh, I would say so. Kind of cool. That didn't, that might have put me off of investigating for a while.
It definitely got my attention. I went back to the room and had a couple fingers of scotch, you know, and it chilled out for a little bit. But, you know, it like I said, every time the lightning would flash, he was just that much closer to me. And, man, that last lightning flash, I mean, he was right up in my face, and he did not look happy. And that's when I went to push him back and just completely threw him. It was crazy.
Well, talking about some of these lost legends and treasures, you know, you've got the Ozark Mountains of Missouri and Arkansas, they hold a lot of secrets, right? You've got buried treasures, lost mines, stacks of Spanish silver and gold bars, silver mines, hidden outlaw loot. So you kind of got the whole myriad of that. I mean, do you have places like that that are so filled with that history? And I would guess that there's probably some really irritable ghosts and curses that surround these areas as well to keep you from trying to find them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the best stories, I think, about the, you know, lost treasures in the Ozarks is the Spanish treasure that's supposed to be down around Bread Train Mountain, the Branson area down there.
Mm-hmm.
The story goes that the Spanish came up from Mexico and they were, you know, killing the Native Americans and stealing whatever they could that was valuable. And by the time they made it up to this area, they had this huge cache of silver with them. Well, they got attacked by the Osage, the Osage Indians that were living in this area at the time, and there was this cave on Bread Tray Mountain that they pushed all the silver into, and then they covered it up, you know, to hide it. Well, the Indians knew the location of it, and the Spanish were all killed, so nobody ever came back for it. Well, the location of the supposed treasure was passed down through the Indians, and when the Delaware Indians were moved from Indiana and Illinois over here to Missouri, they were paid for their land in silver script. And they found out about the treasure, supposed treasure, from the Osage. And when two brothers, Solomon and James Yoakum, came into the area, they made friends with the Delaware and found out about the where the treasure was at. Well, at that time, it wasn't illegal to make your own money as long as it didn't say United States on it. So they supposedly went and got some of this treasure, and they were making their own silver dollars that said Yoakum on one side and $1 on the other. And that was recognized currency in this area, you know, back in the early 1800s. I mean, people even paid for their land with it. And as the story goes, James and his wife had went in to retrieve some of the treasure, and the cave collapsed on them. And, you know, they were so far back, apparently this went so far back that it was too far to dig them out. So Solomon and his family went on and moved on to California. Well, in the 50s, one of his descendants showed back up and had a map. It showed where Bread Tray Mountain was at and where this town was supposed to be at the time where the Yoakums lived. And they couldn't locate it. They couldn't match up the hand-drawn map to the location. And it passed into the hands of a guy by the name of Hardy Ayers. And he's been looking for that treasure for forever. And supposedly, if you get close to where it's at, you know, and I'm kind of skeptical about the whole curse thing, but they say that if you get close to where the treasure mine is at or the treasure trove is at, that the ghost of, you know, James Yoakum will appear to try to warn you off, because I guess the instability of the, you know, what's left of the cave, I would suppose. But that story's been around for a long time. Now, personally, my own personal opinion, Solomon Yoakum was busted for selling liquor to the Indians. And, you know, the only way he could have had silver script at that time was to get it from the Delawares, which would have been an admission of guilt for selling them the liquor. So my opinion is he sold them the liquor, he took the silver script, melted it down, and made Yoakum dollars and invented the story about the treasure mine. But there's a lot of people who don't think along my lines on that. Hardy Ayers is one. And he actually found, or a friend of his found on some of his land, a big silver bar. It's probably, well, it's probably about 10 inches long by 3.5 inches wide by probably 3 inches thick. And it's got, back then they used to carve symbols that stood for certain Spanish galleons and commanders and that kind of stuff on there. And it's got a bunch of different symbols on it. He's got a picture of it he keeps in a lockbox at the bank. So he's convinced that treasure's there.
There's something to a lot of these stories, right? And you like to dig into the history. That's part of what fascinates me about different aspects of the paranormal, right? The history that lies behind these stories. And, you know, with all of the ideas of these lost mines and lost treasures, are there ever things that are turned up that start to really kind of reinvigorate those thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even with the Yoakum, I mean, there's from time to time a Yoakum dollar will turn up. Somebody will find one and, you know, plowing up a garden spot and boom, up pops Yoakum dollar. Or they're tearing down an old cabin or something and they'll find one under the floorboards and that ignites everything back up again. And, you know, there's all kinds of these stories, you know, supposedly Bell Star and Jesse James and the Youngers robbed a bank over in the eastern part of Missouri. And Posse was on their trail, you know, trying to track him down, and they got over by Eureka Springs and split up, and they carved some symbols, you know, took a pickaxe or a shovel or something, whatever they had, and they carved some symbols into this rock with an arrow pointing to the direction where they had buried the treasure, you know, the money that they had stole from the bank. And Bell Star headed on towards Oklahoma, and the Youngers went south, and the James boys headed back north, splitting up different directions, and supposedly the lawmen had followed the Jameses back north, and they ambushed them right there by the Missouri-Arkansas line and killed all the, you know, the lawmen. But from time to time, somebody will find a rock down there with some kind of a symbol on it, and boom, there goes the treasure thing again. Everybody and their cousins out with a metal detector and poking around trying to, you know, figure out where the treasure's at.
That's cool. I love those kind of stories, and especially the idea that that stuff might still exist around. And it's, you know, I sold coins for many years, so it sounds like these Yoakum dollars were very much in the idea of the California fractional dollars, that individual jewelers would start minting coins. And that was because people didn't like just paying in pinches of silver or gold dust, because these establishments would always hire guys with big fingers, so they'd reach their mitts in there and they'd get these big pinches of gold dust. And so they decided, we want some kind of you know, regular strike. And there weren't all of these, what do you call them, treasuries. There weren't the mints around everywhere. So they had to do with what they had to do. So some of these places would strike these coins, and it would become the local currency of the area. So it's kind of cool and fascinating to hear those kind of stories and know that they still exist out there. What's one of the coolest legends out there? And have you gone yourself out in search of fame and fortune with any of these?
Oh yeah, I've looked for the Yoakum dollar, the Yoakum treasure mine. I'll have to admit to that one too. I got sucked into that one. I looked for it too. But the one that fascinated me the most was the Irish Wilderness, which is off to the east of Springfield. It's in the Mark Twain National Forest. And the story goes that there was a settlement there that an Irish priest from St. Louis had helped founded. And during the Civil War, a bunch of marauders came in. They killed a bunch of people, and they kept coming back, and they kept coming back. So they all decided they were going to go to where the well was at in the center of town. And so many feet from the center of the well, that's where they dug down and they buried all the silver and stuff like that that everybody had, so that whenever the marauders would come back, you know, they had nothing worth stealing. Well, the marauders come back, couldn't find anything, and they killed most of the people. And then the priest took everybody else back towards St. Louis with plans for everybody to come back after the war was over, but nobody ever came back. And you can locate where the old town is at. You can find the well. I've been all over that place with a metal detector, and I can't find not so much as a pull tab off a beer can. You know? I've got out there, and I've looked, and I can't find it. But there's so many accounts of that story out there that you can't help but think that there's some truth to it. I mean, the priest existed. There's records of the priest existing. There's legend. There's records of the town existing. There's records of, you know, the marauders, the people being killed there. I mean, there's records that substantiate the story. But whether it's quite a distance from the, you know, where the center of the well is at, or whether it's up close, I mean, you just kind of go in a big concentric circle around there, you know, trying to get a hit off of something. But like I said, you couldn't even find a, you know, a Prince Albert can, you know, tobacco can out there. It's just nothing.
But it keeps us going, right? Every now and again, you get one little coin pops up, and it's like Las Vegas, just enough to keep everybody excited and in the idea.
Yeah, especially here in the Ozarks. I mean, you've got all these old abandoned farms and stuff. And back in the day, the old-timers, they would stash their coins. You know, they'd take and cut a section of the wall out, and they'd put their mason jars in there, and they'd put that section of the wall back, you know, hiding their money. Or they'd go out next to the tree that they'd planted, and they'd bury it, you know, 2 feet down, and you'd find these four or five mason jars full of old coin. That stuff is being found all the time, you know, and it's still being found today, you know. So that's part of the fire that fuels people to get out there and look. I think you'll hear these stories, you know, that somebody found a mason jar full of, you know, silver dollars, you know, Walking Liberty silver dollars or something, you know, and that fires everybody up, you know, and they're all out there looking, trying to find.
But I want to roll back into some ghosty tales and some creepy legends, and talk to me about some of the more obscure, weird stuff that you found that was so fascinating while you were doing the research for all of these great books.
You know, some of the stuff that I found interesting was along the Natchez Trace. I don't know if you've ever been down along there. It's 444 miles long, and at its widest, I think it's like 200 yards. You know, it's the longest, widest national park in existence, and it's got a 50-mile-an-hour speed limit, no commercial vehicles. It's like stepping back in time when you go on this thing, you know. But in the town of Natchez, where it's the southern terminus is at, there's the Natchez Cemetery. And one of the weirdest things I've encountered was the grave of a little girl, Florence Irene Ford. And she died in the 1830s of yellow fever. And this little girl was deathly afraid of thunderstorms. And anytime a storm would come in, she'd crawl up in her mama's lap, and her mama would comfort her through the storm, you know. Well, when she died of yellow fever, her mom had her casket made with the part where the head is at was made with glass in the end so you could see in it. And when she buried her, she had a pit dug at the end of the grave and had it lined with rock with steps going down in there and big metal doors that would close. And any time a thunderstorm would come around, the mom would go down in the pit and close the doors, and she'd sit with her daughter, you know, her daughter's body, until the thunderstorm was over. Then she would go out. Well, they take and they keep those doors closed all the time, but every time after a thunderstorm, you come to the cemetery and the doors are open, like the mom has been down there and she had just come up out of there. And unfortunately, they had to brick up the part where the grave was at because of vandals. You know, people know no respect. But I found it really odd that when you would go there, and if you would do an EVP session, if you would go down into the pit itself, and if you'd close the doors, and I mean, it is pitch black when you're down at the bottom of that. But if you're sitting there and you're doing an EVP session, you'll hear giggles. And one time we got an EVP, you could hear a little girl's voice really, really softly going, "I'm so scared. I'm so tired." And it's always kind of heartbreaking, really, when you get those kind of EVPs. But it's just so much activity in just that one little space right there where her grave is at. It's like she just can't.
That is heartbreaking. Is there anything you do? Do you try to help figure out a way to cross these spirits over, bring somebody in, or do you just believe in just going and recording the history of it and the experiences?
Well, I try to bring people in sometimes if I can find somebody that I know for certain that can actually do it. They're just not, you know, full of crap. You get a lot of people nowadays that are, you know, you look up everywhere on Facebook and I'm a medium, you know, I'm a psychic, and you know, you just don't know who to believe anymore. There are some people who are very talented in that aspect, and then there's some people that are like Norman Baker, they're just shysters. But I do try to bring somebody in to try to help move them on if possible. And I'm always recording for the history part. I mean, the history is, it's my thing. I'm kind of a geek when it comes to that. But, you know, for a situation like that, I brought a lady in. I'm not going to mention her name, but brought her in to try to help move this little girl on. And apparently it didn't work, because you can still go there today and you'll find the, you know, the gates open leading down into the pit. And if you do an EVP session down there, you'll still get, you know, little giggles and what sounds like a little girl whispering and that kind of stuff down there. So I don't know why she stays, if she's tired and scared, but why she won't move on, or maybe she's waiting for her mom. I don't know, but it's kind of a sad deal, really.
Yeah, very sad. Just disheartening, right? I mean, And there's nothing more powerless feeling than hearing these things. Now, do you have any concerns that, especially when it's these helpless children or women, ghosts crying out, do you ever have fear that by trying to engage them and help them or do something, that maybe it's not really what it appears to be? It's something trying to trick you?
Yeah. You know, you hear those stories all the time. You know, you get the warnings of, oh, it may not be a little girl. They're trying to lure you in, or that kind of thing, you know?
Right.
And, you know, you have those concerns. You know, you can't really do this kind of work. I mean, I've been doing paranormal investigations for 38 years. I did my first one in 1979. And, you know, you can't do it as long as I have and not have those concerns and not bring things home with you, too. I mean, that happens. But, you know, there's the potential that, you know, the things that you're interacting with may not be what they appear to be. I mean, that's, you know, my theory all along is, you know, you'll hear these people say, you know, it's a demon. Well, you know, it's probably not a demon. My theory is, if you are a good guy in life, you're probably going to be a good guy in death. If you were a real asshole in life, you're probably going to be an asshole when you're dead. You know, so it's not
don't really, hold back. How do you really feel?
Yeah, you know, it's just how it is. But, you know, it's not a demon. It's just a disgruntled, you know, just a crabby old dude, you know, or an old lady. But There is that potential that, you know, you could be interacting with something that's not, you know, a former human or a human entity. So you always have to be careful. But, know, I bring things. I brought a little girl ghost home with me from somewhere. I'm not sure where she came from, but you know, in our old house, I woke up one morning and you know, you kind of how you lay on your side and you got your arm thrown out.
Right.
I've got 10-year-old twin girls and somebody was holding my hand, you know, and I woke up, I thought it was one of the twins and it was this little girl standing there and then boom, she was just gone. And I'd see her peek around the corner of the hallway and that kind of stuff, but she never bothered anything. She never bothered anybody. She'd play with my girls' toys and that kind of stuff. But I guess maybe she felt safe here or something. You know, there was a family. She felt safe, I would suppose. But one day she just was gone. We never saw her again. So I don't know what happened to her.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? Just so much activity out there, right? Such a rich history. We've just got a few minutes left together. And talking through this, was there any stories that you heard that have hit kind of legendary status that when you went to investigate and break down the history, it really kind of fell apart for you?
Yeah, sadly. There's a cemetery in Biloxi, and it's a privately owned cemetery. It sits out towards on the other side of Ocean Springs. And the legend that was associated with this particular cemetery was epic. I mean, everything from, you know, a person hanging from the tree, which, you know, the body swaying, you would see it in the moonlight, and you could actually do the research and find out that a man had hung himself on that tree. You know, so you could actually relate, you know, to the stories and everything that was going on. But then once you started delving into it and starting investigating it more, then you would come to find out that these historical records of the guy hanging himself turned out to be a story that somebody had wrote for the paper at Halloween. And it just kind of grew and took on a life of its own and just became this big urban legend of this haunted cemetery with the ghost, the hanging ghost in the tree. And then it morphed into an old lady sitting by the gate, you know, and it just completely took on a life of its own. And, you know, I was kind of excited to go check that place out because, you know, I found one account of that story of the guy hanging. And I got there and I checked it out. I mean, it's nothing, peaceful, perfect place. You know, if I had to die, that's where I'd want to be planted, is right there, because it was a peaceful place. And I thought, well, this can't be, you know, the right cemetery. And then I got to researching it a little bit more, and then I found an earlier story of the guy hanging. And like I said, it was that Halloween story somebody had written, and it just kind of bummed me out. You know, it just, there was this whole urban legend that just disintegrated into nothing.
Unbelievable stuff. But it's been such a pleasure talking to you and catching up. And I wish we had more time when we were out at the event and I'd been feeling a little bit better so that we could actually spend time talking. Like I said, I wanted to try to avoid passing on my man flu to anybody else. But hopefully we'll get a chance to hook up again next year and go through this. I know you're working on three new books. What are the topics you're going to be working on going forward?
I'm working on one now that's got to be turned into publisher in mid-March. It's on Haunted Fort Smith. And another book is another Haunted Ozarks book. And the third book, you know, you're familiar with the Valeska axe murders.
Everybody knows that.
I woke up one day and I was thinking about it. And I thought, you know, that's an awfully personal way to kill somebody, whack them with an axe. You know, they just didn't wake up one morning and say, I think I'm going to go kill somebody with an axe this morning. That's kind of built up over time. And so I got to researching it, and I found previous murders that fit the same MO with the lamp, chimney being taken off the lamp, placed under the table, and the bedclothes being thrown back over the bodies and then beat on some more with the axe. And then I found some that was after Valeska in Columbia, Missouri, and then down around Memphis. And my thought was I was going to try to tie it to the Axeman in New Orleans because there was some similarities there. But when I got to looking farther south, I found that there were some African-American families, some black families in Louisiana and Texas that had been killed exactly the same way, with the lamp being taken off the chimney, put under a chair or under a table, killed with the axe, bedclothes thrown over them, hit some more with the axe. So my theory was is the guy was killing the white families. The heat got on him. It got too much of a risk to kill the white families back here in the early 1900s, so he switched to killing the black families because back then nobody cared, you know, down south. It wasn't anything that bothered anybody, sadly. And but that's the book I'm working on now. That's going to be taking quite a while to get that one finished, to go to these different places and any of them that's still standing to investigate them and do a paranormal investigation, see if I can get any EVPs that I can match up from place to place to place and find any commonalities with it.
Yeah, we've had a couple of people visit us from the Villisca axe murder on our show over the years, and I've heard some of the most bone-chilling, terrifying EVP I've ever heard in my life come out of that location. So good luck with that, bud. Let us know, and we'd love to have you visit with us again. And keep us abreast if there's any new creepy stuff happening in Eureka Springs at the Old Crescent or Basin Hotel. Would you do that?
Oh, absolutely. You know I will.
All right, that's it for tonight, kids. Be safe, love one another. I'll see you again right here tomorrow on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.